From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made a few days ago on the streets of Seattle. The anti-fascist organization, and I guess to the extent that you can call Antifa an organization, some activists posted on Twitter about a Nazi man heading downtown in Seattle and harassing people. And one of the Antifa posters wrote, quote, "There's a Nazi out in downtown Seattle right now with a swastika on him, screaming in people's faces. I just passed him on 3rd and Union-ish, so if you know anyone in the area that would like to give him a beating," end quote. And that's exactly what happened. Maybe you saw the viral video. The video shows a man with a swastika armband, and another man delivers a punch to his face so powerful that the Nazi falls unconscious and a tooth flies from his mouth. That video went viral with tens of thousands of approving tweets and messages. "Knock out the Nazis," the supporters cheered. "No more comfort in public for fascists," others declared. And there are other similar videos out there, so many so that even Noam Chomsky felt the need to weigh in. He said that punching Nazis is wrong in principle and self-destructive in tactics. He wrote, quote, "When confrontation shifts to the arena of violence, it's the toughest and most brutal to win, and that's not us. That's quite apart from the opportunity cost, the loss of the opportunity for education, organizing, and serious and constructive activism," end quote. But today we've been flooded with messages from listeners who say that they can't see the harm in punching Nazis. We're going to read some of those comments coming up. We wanted to discuss this issue. We invited a local group calling itself Eastside Anti-Fascist. We did not receive a reply from them. But in studio, we have Kit Miller, the director of the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester. Kit, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Also here is Lawrence Torcello. He's an RIT professor of philosophy specializing in moral theory and applied ethics. Larry, welcome back to the program to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Well, again, you're going to hear the voices of some people who think that Antifa and the idea of just, you know, sort of dumbing down to punching Nazis, they think, yes, we should do that. I'm going to start with you, Kit. I mean, is there any part of you that sees these videos and says, here we are, it's 2017, we're having these debates, and sometimes violence is going to happen, sometimes violence should happen? How do you feel about it?
I'm with Noam Chomsky. When you lose the moral high ground in an argument, I think you lose. And you lose in the long term. There may be short-term gains, but historically, when you move the argument onto the grounds of who's willing to be the most violent, everybody loses. I'm thinking about Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stevens looking at nonviolence as a form of political change-making, and they looked at over 100 conflicts that occurred between 1900 and 2006 in their analysis. And Erica Chenoweth, by the way, was a big believer in violence. She was all set to have a security analyst job at the CIA. And they found that nonviolence actually worked better in trying to achieve political gains, but more importantly, it yielded a democratic society post-conflict. So what I want to know is, if we're trying to beat the bad guys using violence within our own country, what kind of country is that going to yield us? I want us to be better strategic thinkers than that.
Professor Torcello sent us a brief email yesterday outlining some of his thoughts, and you said that you understand the impulse that some people have to be Indiana Jones on the train punching at a Nazi, that there is a feeling that there is something righteous about that, but what?
I think it's a therapeutic impulse that we have to want to punch the Nazi. I think that many of us just grew up watching people like Indiana Jones punch Nazis. And the real question, I think, is going to have to be, is this an effective way to deal with the rise of white supremacy and a higher profile in the public sphere with regard to racism? And also, is it ever the case, given the presumption against violence that I think has to be recognize, is it ever the case that violence is justifiable on ethical terms? And I think perhaps there can be cases and have been cases. And the question is, are we looking at one of those right now? And I tend to agree with Noam Chomsky and Kit on this, that at this point, we're not there where we should risk something that might undermine democratic principles and the rule of law, potentially.
Here is one of the rejoinders to what Kit was describing as a historical set of arguments and tactics that has been effective, which is nonviolence. Writing for the New Statesman, Jasper Jackson writes, "Is it okay to punch a Nazi?" He says, "There are moral and practical reasons why using force to stop a far-right march is justified." I want to read at length what he writes here, Kit, and we'll talk about it. He writes, quote, "On a pragmatic level, there is plenty of evidence from history to suggest that nonviolent protest has had a greater impact. From Gandhi to the fall of the Berlin Wall, nonviolence has often been the most effective tool of political movements fighting oppression, achieving political goals, and forcing change. But the success of those protests was largely built on their ability to embarrass the governments they were arrayed against. Unfortunately, it's a hell of a lot more difficult to embarrass a Nazi. They don't have legitimacy to lose. In fact, they gain legitimacy by marching unopposed, as if their swastikas and burning crosses were just another example of political free expression. By contrast, the far right do find being physically attacked embarrassing. Their movement is based on the glorification of victory, of white supremacy, of masculine and racial superiority, and scenes of white supremacists looking anything but superior undermines their claims. And when it comes to Nazis marching on the streets, the lessons from history show that physically opposing them has worked. The most famous example is the Battle of Cable Street in London, in which a march by thousands of Hitler-era Nazis was stopped parading through East End by a coalition of its Jewish community, dock workers, other assorted locals, trade unionists, and communists," end quote. So Kit, Jasper Jackson is saying, in many ways, yes, the upper hand of history says nonviolence is the way to go. Here's the exception. You can't embarrass a Nazi. Physical domination is the only way to embarrass and to make the point and to block them from achieving their means. Is that a compelling argument to you?
Well, I have to say that it is not, because I don't think that you're just embarrassing a Nazi. You're also you're embarrassing a human being who has taken on the ideology of Nazism. So underneath the Nazi label is a human being. And I turn to some of the books that have been read or written recently, such as Frank Meek's book, who's, skinhead or former skinhead whose life was created or emulated from that American History X movie that starred Edward Norton. And Meek was interviewed after the events of Charlottesville. And, his point was that when you oppose people who are already convinced that they are this suppressed minority, which is when many white supremacists see themselves as a suppressed minority in this country. So when you kind of give violence onto those people, it's actually a great recruiting tactic for them. So I would say that the more violence we visit upon these humans, according to Frank Meek, we're just helping them to recruit. So I don't think that that's a very skillful move myself.
Okay. And Larry, what do you think?
I would agree with that. I think it has to be maintained and said at the beginning of this conversation, though, that of course there isn't a moral equivalence between Antifa and white supremacists and the Nazis, neo-Nazis, KKK. And I share the goals that they have. I'm very, very sympathetic to their cause. I agree with Kit. I don't think it's the most effective way to fight the rise of racism. Also, Peter Singer, along with Noam Chomsky, another philosopher, has written on this topic, pointing out that though Antifa traces back their roots to pre-World War II opposition to the Nazis, that in that case, it wasn't clearly effective. In fact, it hardened support for Hitler and allowed the premise of the plausibility of cracking down to establish rule of law. And I think that if history is going to repeat itself, and Antifa warns us it could, then we have to look at history as a whole and see how things can backfire historically and lead to effects, the very effects that you're seeking to counter with violence.
Listeners, if you want to call the program and weigh in on this, it's 844-295-TALK. Toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Lawrence Torcello is an RIT professor of philosophy specializing in moral theory and applied ethics. Kit Miller, director of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. We don't have any panelists who are pro-punching Nazis, but there are plenty of people just from our Twitter feed. And what I did want to do, because we couldn't, just based on scheduling and availability, bring in anybody right now who's going to advocate for this tactic, I did want to pull some sound with someone who has. So before we get to your phone calls, you're going to hear a couple of clips here. This is Yvette Falarca. She is with a group called By Any Means Necessary. They call themselves BAM. And they primarily operate in California, but they share the goals of Antifa, and they're aligned with Antifa. And here is Yvette Falarca on a day in which there was an attempted organizing and petitioning rally for Nazism and fascism. And her organization, BAM, By Any Means Necessary, used violence. They physically dragged some members who were trying to organize and attract members to Nazism. They dragged them through the streets. Some were attacked. There were some bloody incidents. No one was killed in this particular event in California. But Yvette Falarca was interviewed at length afterwards. And first, let's listen to her talking about the group, By Any Means Necessary, and her assessment of that day.
The Nazis and the fascists are dangerous. They need to be stopped and shut down by any means necessary. We can't just ignore them, because then they grow. They hold these rallies not to just talk to each other. They're trying to recruit. But today, they looked as weak as they are. They had to run hiding. And we want to make sure that happens. And we're committed to making sure that if they try to show their faces publicly again and hold any other rally, whether it's in Sacramento, whether it's any other place in California or nationally, BAM is building and leading a movement that's committed to building militant, integrated, direct action to shut them down by any means necessary.
And then when Falarca was asked about this accusation that her side is cheapening their cause by resorting to violence, and are they a violent organization, By Any Means Necessary, here is what she said to that.
I say it's self-defense, and it is what we have to do, because if we ignore them and allow them to just hold their recruitment rallies, they are not nonviolent. They are organizing to attack and kill us. So we have a right to self-defense. We have an obligation to that.
All right, so Kit Miller, is there anything compelling in those words that you hear there?
Absolutely. I support her goals 100%. I'm just worried about the strategies. I think that there's all sorts of ways that are creative, often like really humorous, to get to kind of mock and make fun of people without resorting to violence that could actually achieve the goals probably more effectively. And again, I'm looking at post-conflict. What kind of society are we going to have if taking to the streets to fight out our problems is what we do? I'm also worried about, frankly, this kind of action, as if it becomes more common, giving an excuse for anyone in our federal government who's interested in peeling back more of our civil liberties to take action. I don't want to live in a police state. I don't want to live in more of a police state than we already do. And I think that there's a possibility that these kind of activities could create that kind of society. And my kids live in this country, and I don't want them to live like that.
Yeah, Yvette Falarca was asked in multiple interviews, you know, where do you draw the line? When is it okay to physically attack someone for espousing a view? And she said she draws the line at how whatever she defines as fascism, she thinks should not be allowed. That's where she thinks freedom of speech stops. And she believes that is defined as any kind of recruitment, incitement, support for an organization or Nazism or fascism, because that is a movement that would condone violence against already oppressed groups in this country, many, many people, and that therefore that's where the line is, and that we should sort of all get on board with the fact that shaming, mocking isn't enough, that we can't allow that, because if we allow it in any form, it grows. What do you think, Kit?
I think fighting it with violence is what grows it. And I'm not making this up. There's just a tremendous amount of research about how do you relate to these circumstances. And so, again, I applaud her passion. And I don't want to have anybody not feel rage even about the threat of these kinds of things going on. But I also want us to be able to think coolly and strategically for the long run, you know, to not be driven like scared chickens from one event to another, but to really be able to be thoughtful. I think the long-term consequences of this for us are very, very alarming.
Okay. And Professor Torcello, anything that you heard from Yvette Falarca from the group By Any Means Necessary that you think sways you at all towards saying, okay, I see where she's coming from in advocating for militant and what she describes as self-defense, but militant, even violence against fascism?
I think I see where she's coming from, but I'm not convinced that she has the proper strategy in this case. If the goal is to disrupt recruitment, I don't believe there's any evidence that violent organization disrupts recruitment. We've seen this, and I'm not comparing anyone to terrorists here, but by analogy, we've seen this in the war on terror. The idea that we can attack every form of hatred with overwhelming violence is something that has failed historically. And it leads to exactly a hardening of the people that we're trying to oppose. And it often leads to political outcomes that are antithetical to the goals that have been proclaimed on the part of, in this case, Antifa or others who think that violence is the most effective course. Of course, Antifa does a lot of things, as far as I understand, that don't involve violence. And I think that all of their nonviolent actions should be applauded. It's just this part of their strategy that I think is a failed strategy that's dangerous. And one more thing, the principle of free speech is often evoked in this context, but it's not in isolation to the principle of toleration that is also tied and bound to a principle of nonviolence. And all of these principles taken together form the historical liberal foundation of the constitutional democracy that we live in. And we could talk about its pros and cons and failures historically. But I think that it's dangerous to take slivers of principles that belong to an overall Enlightenment tradition and then treat them in isolation, as we often hear in this issue.
You also say, both of you say, you know, and we'll get to your phone calls in just a second. So listeners, we're going to come to you for some of your feedback on this. Both of our guests saying, you know, historically, the evidence shows that this is not a good way to win an argument or win a movement or to stamp out recruitment. In fact, it can grow recruitment. And here's where I'd like to ask Yvette Falarca, where I think she kind of goes wrong, Professor, is this. You know, she says, we won that day. Eventually, they left the streets. They stopped recruiting. We drove them out. That ignores the fact that videos go viral and that they are very effective to organizing online and sharing this message saying, you see why we need, you know, such and such organization, white nationalism, Nazism, look at what they're doing, they're coming for us. And I think she's ignoring the fact that just in the physical space that day, yes, you beat them up and they left. But I don't think that that is evidence that they have won the day, do you?
No, not at all. And it plays into their propaganda, as you're pointing out. And so they won that day. What if the next time they lose? By that reasoning, then it's just an arbitrary, you know, use of force against force. And so they may win the next day, and they're going to react in the same way with viral videos and memes. It seems to be an emotionally driven, ill thought out strategy against hatred.
All right, let's take some of your phone calls. I'm going to start with Mike in Irondequoit first step. Go ahead, Mike.
A fascinating, as usual, discussion, and I'm glad it's a discussion and not screaming.
Agreed.
I remember when I was much, much younger, being instructed many times that there's no excuse to permit somebody else's unacceptable behavior to make my behavior unacceptable. That is up to me. And I'm not saying I wouldn't defend myself, but going on the attack, I think, is stepping over the line. That's my two cents worth.
Yeah, Mike, thank you. I mean, it sounds to me like Mike, Kip and Professor Torcello, Mike sounds like he's reflecting some of that concern, that this is a bridge too far right now, that this is not a situation that, you know, and Larry said earlier, maybe there are moments where violence is momentarily moral in a situation. Mm-hmm. Mike is not seeing that in this moment.
Yeah, I agree, and I don't see it in this moment either. I think there's a very strong presumption against violence, and you have to ask yourself, the violence that I'm about to undertake, is this something that is going to, in the long term, actually make a big difference in terms of a greater violence that I'm opposing? And I don't think we're there in this society yet. We do still have a democracy in place. We do still have rule of law, and it's imperfect. And we can go through all of the ways it's imperfect, but the violence undermines that each time it's relied upon a little bit. And we always have to make that balance. And I think that we're not making the right calculation in the current circumstances that we're discussing.
Well, think about this, Twit. On Twitter, let me ask Kit Miller. On Twitter, Don writes to us and says, and he's a local listener. He says, "I'm alt-right. Condoning this violence is a tacit admission that ordinary people are receptive to my ideas, and I agree." So there's somebody who identifies as alt-right, sees this as just more admission that his side is growing, as opposed to feeling like it's stamping it out. On top of that, I would say this, and I'm curious to get your feeling on this, Kit. I don't mean to be Pollyanna or naive, and I want to be very sensitive to the fact that I am in a super privileged position where I am not really vulnerable. As rough as things are for many people in this country, I rarely, if ever, feel that myself. I want to acknowledge that. And we're going to talk more about that next hour, by the way. That's part of the conversation next hour, because people who are vulnerable in different ways feel things in different ways. So I totally understand that. But having had conversations, having read extensively about white nationalism, there are violent, and I mean abjectly ready to be violent today, white nationalists. And there are many white nationalists who also say the goal is ethnostates, nonviolently, because they fear multiculturalism. Their feeling is that multiculturalism and proximity leads to violence, whether we like it or not. And the lesson of history should teach us that we should just separate into ethnostates, do it voluntarily, and not have violence. So I believe in winning this battle of ideas. I believe I know it sounds like, what are you, crazy? You're going to try to reach out to white nationalists and convince them? And my answer is, I want to try. Yeah, I do. I want to have that conversation. I want to start from a place of understanding, because I fear that these viral videos do nothing but sort of fuel this idea that, see, look at the violence being visited upon us, told you, as opposed to, let's have a conversation about your fear of multiculturalism. Where does it come from? And let's talk about it. How do you feel about that, Kit?
A couple of things. Like, one, I appreciate both Don and Mike's perspectives. I mean, for me, I also just always, I never want to lose sight of the fact in any choice that I'm making, this is my one life. It's not a dress rehearsal. And like, I ultimately define myself in terms of my morality. So how am I in any situation, how do I want to relate in such a way that I can die with a good, clear conscience? So like, that's sort of part of what fundamentally fuels my work in the world. I have been doing a lot of looking and thinking about this as it's come up, and also especially interested in it from a systemic standpoint. Again, just not to be sort of blown around by the media or blown around by the events, but trying to step back and look at it. And one of the things that Peter Senge says, who's an internationally known systems person out of Massachusetts Institute of Technology, his perspective is that generally right before a system changes, it furiously tries to do what it's always done to ward off the change. It's possible, in my opinion, that this sort of burst of activity from the white supremacy standpoint actually could be the last gasp of energy before our country fully embraces like the fact of the white, our population changing and becoming a more multicultural society. The opposition is essentially providing a reinforcing loop to strengthen that last burst that last burst of trying to ward off this change of truly becoming a multicultural society. So that's just one of the reasons why I'm worried that when we're helping, you know, accidentally to fuel that, that we're actually doing the exact opposite. We're pushing the lever of change in the exact opposite of the way that we might want to change. So again, I just really think it's so important for people to think very carefully and critically, because we are deciding what the society is going to look like 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road. We've had a rollback in our civil liberties since September 11th, and we need to really be thoughtful about not giving excuses for that to continue.
All right, one more question for our guests, and then listeners, if you're on the phone, the second half hour is all your phone calls, because we have a lot to work through. But we had an off-air comment. I'm going to ask both of our guests to try to do this as quickly as we can, but it's a good historical question. Carol wants to know, can your guests give concrete examples of when nonviolent protests did work? Kit, I know you're ready with that one. Just some short examples of when nonviolence was the answer and was effective.
Montgomery, Alabama. The Salt March in India, well, those are two of the most famous. There's plenty of other ones. I can point Carol towards a number of books on the topic. Michael Nagler's book, For Future to Be Possible, is filled with these examples. And the bottom line is that most of us have never learned about these stories because they're people power stories, and they don't very easily like fit with what sometimes what the powers that be want us to understand, because they're very powerful when people get together in nonviolent ways. There's a lot out there. And I'm happy for people to reach out to me directly. I've got tons of information on this.
Okay, Professor?
Every time somebody changes their position in a debate, at any time we choose discussion over violence, that's an effective use of nonviolence. The history of philosophy is a choice to talk to one another rather than engage in warfare. And that's what civilization is premised upon. Many white supremacists say that they're defending Western civilization. I've read many of the great philosophical works of Western civilization, and I can tell you they're not. Western civilization is premised upon rejecting violence and choosing reasoned discourse. And every time we do that, it succeeds.
Let's get our only break of the hour. Every phone line's filled, and we're going to go back to your phone, the phone lines after our only break. We're talking with Kit Miller, the director of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence, and Professor Lawrence Torchello from RIT. He specializes in moral theory and applied ethics as a professor of philosophy. Your phone call's next. Coming up in our second hour, Jiva Theater does their annual curtain call in the spring. New York City has its versions that bring the media, journalists, and politicians together. Albany does it. There's the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And then there was Sean Spicer at the Emmys. Are these good ideas? Is it good to laugh, to come together a bit? Or do we normalize bad behavior among government leaders? Is it the wrong thing to do? We'll discuss it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's go down to Pen Yan, listening on Finger Lakes Public Radio, WEOS. Carrie is next up. Go ahead, Carrie.
Hi. I wanted to share an experience I had when I first heard about the attack in Charlottesville. I had the radio on, as I always do, and I was only kind of half listening. And when I first heard the story, I thought that what happened was that someone had driven their car into the white supremacist protesters. And I remember thinking to myself, yeah, finally, you know, finally we're getting one back at them. And then I had to kind of stop and think, wait a minute, is that how I really feel about this? And then, of course, I heard the correct story, and it was just, it was kind of an eye-opening moment for me.
Do you feel the same way then momentarily when you see those videos of you know, the viral videos of the people punching Nazis? Do you have those moments where you say, yeah, I got what you deserved?
I have to admit, I haven't seen those.
Okay. But it's
but
just,
I have heard, yeah. I have heard a lot on this topic just listening to NPR all day on different programs. And, you know, I don't know how I feel about it.
Well, Carrie, why don't you hang there for a second? And, Professor, I'll start with you. What do you make of her sort of wrestling with that momentary, hey, good, you know, that kind of that visceral feeling that happens, yeah, and then kind of pulling back a little?
Well, thank you for sharing that. And I think we're always making moral choices. And I think that you know, and I share this impulse so many people have to want to punch Nazis. I get that. I really do. That's visceral. And whenever something feels so visceral that you should do it, and that's probably when we need to take a step back and actually apply some critical thought aimed at ourselves. And so I think that's just part of being a moral person, is to not go with your impulse all the time. We have good and bad impulses. We have to check them with our intellect.
Kit, how do you feel about it?
I'm just pulling up a little quote from the only person that I know that was an eyewitness to Charlottesville is a rabbi named Mordecai Liebling. He lost his entire extended family in a Holocaust. So I think you can make a decent argument that compared to most people in this country, Rabbi Liebling has the most reason and rationale to want to punch a Nazi. And Liebling said something very different. He said, "We are faced with a difficult challenge. We cannot tolerate white supremacy, and we must listen to the fear and pain that many of its supporters carry. These are the fears of the rank and file followers, and contrary to the facts of wealth, income, or education, they believe they are losing ground relative to non-white groups. It's the work of those white people who are able to hear their pain to attempt to reach over barriers and advocate for policies that will benefit them as well. Dehumanizing and dismissing them leads to more hatred. We will not bring about a more just society through violence." So I defer to Rabbi Liebling. Like, if he, again, someone I know, that if he said, yes, we should go punch Nazis, my family was killed by them, and this, like, latter-day resurgence of them is intolerable, then I would be far more inclined to go with the ideas. But this guy actually, for me, stands for the people that have truly lost through fascism and still are willing to stand for the values of the kind of things that we've been talking about, what this society is built on.
All right, so this is someone clearly vulnerable and has lost. So Carrie, you know, I guess as you conclude the conversation today, do you know in your head, I mean, do you feel any sort of conclusion on where you stand on the issue now?
Yeah, definitely. And I do remember feeling, after that initial impression that I had, feeling a little embarrassed, because normally people on what I consider my side of the argument don't act like that. And so I thought, wait a minute, what, you know, how come all of a sudden, you know, this side is being violent? So I do. But it was very interesting to me that my initial, you know, impression was, oh, good, finally, you know, but no. Mm.
Can I just say something really quick? I just really appreciate you, Carrie, because, like, there's a kind of empathy that we're looking for sometimes, and we've been educated to think that other people being harmed sometimes can give us that sense of relief or a sense of, like, somehow that I can feel better through that. And I'm celebrating that you were able to see through that actually that's not the right medicine for the pain. Thank you.
Thanks for the phone call, Carrie. I think that was very introspective and very open and honest about this. As we continue through much of your response, so stay on the phones. We've got time to work through this. Jim writes to us and says, "Evan, if these Antifa types use threats of physical intimidation and violence in order to silence or shame or scare people they don't like, how are they any different than the Nazis they claim to oppose?" Now, this is where Professor Tortello wants to reel back and say he is not supporting violence, but he is also not equating here. You want to make that point again?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, there's no way to, I think, justify an equivalency between white supremacists and those who oppose them. And Antifa, they do a lot more than grab headlines through violence. I'm not a scholar of Antifa, but I understand that there's a lot more organizing and direct actions that are not violent that are going on there. I just disagree with them on this aspect of their approach. I share their goals. There's no moral equivalency, and we have to be careful about that, because I think that muddies the water and blurs the discourse here.
Well, Roxanne writes to us and says, "The framework of your discussion, Evan, reveals a basic bias. Why do you and your guests conflate defense with offensive violence? Dr. Cornel West clearly stated that Antifa saved the lives of the marching clergy in Charlottesville." Mm-hmm. Professor, what do you think?
I don't deny that they may very well have done that. And I think that the police force that was on the scene there perhaps deserves a great deal of our attention, and I think that they made some serious mistakes. And their failure and the fact that Antifa may have saved some lives there doesn't take away from the fact that in the long run, violence just begets more violence and the destruction of more lives. And we have to be in this for the long haul if we're serious.
All right, back to the phones. Robert in Fairport. Go ahead, Robert.
Thanks for taking my call. It's kind of interesting. We're 44 minutes into this segment, and I don't think I've heard any discussion of the legality and, you know, hauling off and, you know, hitting someone. In New York State, I think that that's an assault. Depending upon the severity of the injury, it's either a second-degree assault, which could be a felony, or a third degree, which could be a misdemeanor. I think when you're advocating something like this or suggesting that it could even be reasonable based on somebody's point of view and trying to prevent somebody else from saying something that's objectionable, you're putting yourself in a position where somebody's going to end up being a martyr. You know, what if someone from this group hits a Nazi protester and kills him in one blow? That sort of thing has happened before in bar fights and things like that.
Robert, thank you. Some thoughts from our guests on that.
Even when we're talking about peaceful civil disobedience, when we're talking about breaking any law in the interest of justice, we have to make a calculation. In doing what we're about to do, are we bringing attention to a greater injustice in a way that doesn't threaten to undermine the rule of law ultimately, but rather strengthen it over the long term? And I think when it comes to direct violence, that seldom is accomplished, as opposed to more peaceful forms of protest, civil disobedience being one.
Tristan writes to the program and says that we have to make a distinction, and that, well, let me read the full email and we'll see what our guest says. He says, I'd like to point out a distinction that I feel is not often made between general white nationalism and the KKK or Nazism. Yes, we can have a dialogue with white nationalists to try to convince them off the error of their ways. But as soon as somebody puts on a swastika, they are adopting the trappings of an organization that perpetrated an organized genocide, which was only averted through massive, overwhelming violence on the part of the Allies. I think this distinction is an important one. That's from Tristan. He's saying that that's essentially a declaration of war and a support for violence and genocide. And therefore, when you see that armband, it becomes a different moral calculus if you decide to punch that person in the face or drag him off the street. Kit Miller.
I'm going to say something a little controversial here, which is that the historical documents that I've looked at, and I'm thinking of Mark Kurlansky's book right now on nonviolence, which was very well regarded. The Allies weren't that worried about saving Jewish lives in World War II. There was plenty of documents actually about what was happening in the concentration camps, according to Kurlansky, that we didn't take every action that we could have. So it's a little hypocritical. Like sometimes we go back now and we reframe World War II as saving Jewish lives, but that wasn't such a priority if you look carefully at actually the decisions that our government was making. They were very worried about being painted as pro-Jewish back then, according to what I've read. So I want to just be really thoughtful about, you know, not getting on our like sort of high horse and saying, well, we sacrificed back then, and now, you know, we can't do that. No, I think that there's a much more complex history in this country generally on most topics than we want to acknowledge.
But I suspect Tristan would reply to that by saying, okay, even if we set that aside and agree on that, is wearing a swastika a declaration of support for genocide, the likes of which should be met with some kind of strong response, even violence?
I definitely think it should be met with a strong response. I would question, again, whether violence might end up strengthening that other side. That's every single thing that I read and look at, by and large, says that that's the long-run gain. So that's why I persist in my ideas about nonviolence.
Okay, Professor?
Yeah, a lot has been written on just war theory, and we could talk about the merits of World War II. But just like we can't draw moral equivalency between Antifa and Nazis, I think we ought to avoid drawing any sort of equivalency between fistfights in the streets and world wars. I think they're categorically different, and I think that it's of limited use to try to draw such analogies. When somebody puts a Nazi armband on, I think they're ridiculous. We should probably mock them, have a strong response to them. One of the most, I think, effective things I saw that came out of Charlotte was the use of tubas to make the
I think the tube incident was in Boston as a follow-up. Yeah,
yeah, and it's used, I believe it's used in Germany routinely. And I think it does. It's a very effective way to reveal the cartoonish nature of this sort of organization. Not that they shouldn't be taken seriously, but I do think that sort of thing is effective. And I think in the long term, much more effective and much more sympathetic than violence.
All right, Ingrid in Penfield next on the phone. Go ahead, Ingrid.
Hi, thanks for this program. It's really valuable. I was one of the things I wanted to say has just been mentioned. There's a town, Wunsiedel, in Germany near the Czech border, and they did a genius thing where they turned a neo-Nazi march into a fundraiser where people donated money for every foot or every yard that the people walked, and they donated all that money, which was a lot of money raised, to a program that works against neo-Nazis. They had clowns. They had funny signs. I guess it was really a success, and using humor is going to be much more effective. The person that you patched in from California, she's absolutely right. We absolutely need to shut down this movement, and that is exactly why we should not be using violence. Setting aside the moral question of violence, it is not successful, and that is why we must not use it. I consider that anyone who is using violence is playing into the hands of those who would love us to misbehave so that they will be able to sanction further actions on our parts. The last thing I wanted to say, I don't know what anyone's going to think about this. I personally would love to start a movement for the purpose of saying that we should get rid of the idea that we are acting out of resistance. I think once you have set yourself up as a resistor of anything, you've given away part of your power and your freedom to act, because you require the presence of something you oppose in order to take your own actions. I would rather see us reframing, redefining what we object to in positive terms so that we can see clearly what it is that we want to change the world over to that will help us make that goal turn from something we visualize into something that actually is present, and it allows us to act no matter whether anyone else is acting. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, Ingrid, that's very interesting. First of all, thank you for the phone call. Second of all, we've got a professor of philosophy here, and I wonder how you feel about the way she's framing that. It's an interesting way to look at it, Professor.
Yeah, thank you for that. And thank you for the example. I think that we should strive to be more creative than Nazis, and that's an effective use of our time. In terms of, with regard to resistance, I understand that point. I think the term for some people works and for others it doesn't. And I think that whatever gets people motivated to stand up for principles, democratic principles, peaceful principles, should be embraced. So I understand what you're saying. I don't have strong feelings about the word. And I just think it's important for us all to get out and stand up for justice.
Ingrid, this is Kit. I like what you said, and I've heard that something along the lines in the phrase, state the dream and not the nightmare.
Thank you, Ingrid. But here's Barbara, who emails the program and says, Evan, I'm really torn. On the one hand, I agree with your panel, but I'm also truly afraid for the country. If our president tweets out tacit support for the alt-right and white nationalism, isn't the left losing? He was elected president, after all. We continue to take the high road, but where is it really leading us? Kit?
Where are we seeing that we're taking the high road?
I think what she means is by refusing to commit violence against, even against avowed Nazis or fascists that in the streets, that by taking the high road, by saying we are going to do this in a different way, we are not going to resort to violence, but she's nervous. She feels that the left is losing.
Yeah. I want to say, let's not take the high road. Let's just take the smart road. Again, even let's say that there's this huge throwdown in this country and everybody that we don't like gets kicked out. Who are we after that? We need to be smart. And it's not just the high road. We're not just talking morality here today. We're talking about what historically and has a research basis and what works and what doesn't work in conflict situations. So I share your worry. I really do. And I don't want to dismantle what's good about this country in that effort. And I also want to just be really out there. You know, we're three white people sitting here talking. There's a lot of what's not working in this country, especially for people who are not white. So I don't want to act like, we're just here to defend this perfect state because we're obviously far, far from perfect.
No, right. I mean, Kit is not simply saying, you know, it's immoral to commit violence. She's saying it doesn't work. Historically, the evidence is that it doesn't work and that we need to be very serious about that. And I have emails from those who are expressing sort of similar sentiments here. We could just do this all day. Lots and lots of emails. And I can't even find the one that I was just, essentially a listener wrote to say, if you want to see the impact of violence, ask Al-Qaeda, ask ISIS what happens when we indiscriminately bomb or when we commit violence. Ask if that helps their recruiting. Hmm. Does that stamp out or does that engender more of what you're trying to eliminate? And this emailer sees the principles sort of aligning there. Let me squeeze in another phone call. And we've got Don in East Rochester. Go ahead, Don.
Thank you for taking my call. I couldn't disagree more wholeheartedly with Ingrid from Penfield. There are times when violence does achieve an identifiable goal. We celebrate the American Revolution. That was violent. We celebrate the storming of the Bastille in Paris. That was violence. I'll give you two examples from the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King was one of my first heroes and one of the greatest exemplars of nonviolent resistance in the United States. But there were also some instances when people took guns to defend themselves against terrorism like the Klan. The first instance was by a man named Robert Williams in Monroe, North Carolina. He was president of the local NAACP, and he noticed that the Klan would routinely march down his street with guns. He decided he would organize his community to counter that demonstration also with guns. So when the Klan drove down his street with guns sticking out of their windows, the community responded with guns sticking out of the windows of their houses, and the Klan melted away. The Klan never marched down the streets of his community ever again. Another instance was a group called the Deacons of Defense in Louisiana, and the emphasis in that title is on defense. They would, whenever there was a civil rights demonstration in a certain town in Louisiana, which was the center of their strength, they would defend those marchers with weapons. The Klan, the police would not attack those demonstrators. I'm not saying violence is the only way. I'm saying it is one of many ways.
All right, Don, I got to jump in because we're down to our last 30 seconds. And I'm glad you expressed those thoughts. It's good to get a diversity of viewpoints. Professor, some final thoughts from you based on that phone call. Go ahead.
Just to reiterate, I agree that there are times when violence may be useful and justified. I'm not advocating a complete pacifistic position here. I think that in the case we're talking about, violence is counterproductive and unjustifiable.
Well, listen, I suspect we'll have more conversations on this with, I hope, a lot of different stakeholders and a lot of different viewpoints, because I think most of the people who called this program today, certainly the panelists on this program, have the same goals, the desired outcomes, and elimination of oppression and protection and egalitarianism. But it's a question of how you get there and what we can learn from history and what's happening right now. And no one is saying it's easy, but I want to thank our guests for being here. Lawrence Torcello, RC, professor of philosophy, specializing in moral theory and applied ethics. Always nice to have you. Thanks for coming back on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Kit Miller is the director of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. And if you want to contact the Gandhi Institute, Kit had a caller earlier just asking about books and history and references. What's the best way to get a hold of the Gandhi Institute? Do it in 10 seconds, Kit.
Kit at GandhiInstitute.org.
Kit at GandhiInstitute.org. Thank you. Thank you for being here, as always. Short break. Much more Connections coming up.